This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is June 17th, 2021, and this is episode 244.
I'm Scott Lindebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we have reports from the Liberals on their failure in the election, and we have reports from an expert panel on the province's failures in housing. Both of them try to say what they can do better. We'll dig into it. And happy end of spring session. The House has risen. I think most of the bills got royal assent. Not much to say beyond that. Maybe we'll dig into it next week, but we want to talk about these reports this week. Thanks to the 103 people who contribute to the podcast every month. You can join them at patreon.com/politicoast. Let's dig into the first report. The province has changed and so should the BC Liberals. The election debrief for the BC Liberal election campaign is out. Three consultants from a Toronto firm did a survey of 821 party members. They interviewed 19 officials. They didn't talk to anyone outside the party, it seems, and they've come to some conclusions about what went wrong. Scott, what was your take on this report?
There's nothing too surprising in there. I would have liked to see them go into a little more detail, and I still don't feel it's a very clear example of where the Liberals need to go from here, but that also may be just outside the scope of the report, because as big as the problems were in the past election, and there were many, the big ultimate problem that the Liberals have, and was just not within the terms of reference here, is a broader what does it actually mean to be a Liberal or on the center-right in 2021.
Yeah, there was a lot of focus on the specifics, and they talked to many of the people who are involved in the campaign, and it was two surprising issues, I guess. There's potentially more. Like, on the one hand, I was actually surprised a number of insiders in the party thought Horgan was bluffing, and fair enough, maybe you believed that, but that almost seemed to be an excuse not to be more ready for an election.
Yeah, that surprised me too. Because it certainly didn't seem like Horgan was bluffing in the lead-up to it, and turned out not to be, but it was fairly obvious that the NDP were seriously considering it, and even if they thought he was bluffing, at least have a plan B prepared in case you're wrong on it, which obviously didn't happen.
Yeah, and we were in a minority situation, so an election could have happened at any point. Now, it was a surprisingly stable one still for 3 years. Like, worst case scenario, the Liberals could have been fundraising when they otherwise weren't. So instead, they seem to just fall down on the basics of keeping the party running as a political apparatus, just hoping to get past COVID. And like, when were they going to kick up fundraising? With the limits we have now, you need to be fundraising constantly because you can only pull so much from your big donors. So you need more donors, and they need to donate more often.
Yeah, that was a problem that has basically existed since the rules got updated at the start of the last legislature back in what would have been the fall of 2017. And the Liberals just never did the work to update their fundraising.
And so the other thing that I think I found a little bit surprising among the attitudes of the insiders was this like abject defeatism that seemed to permeate the party going into the election. Now, I think it was realistic that they did not expect to win, but there seemed to be an attitude that they just gave up. Like, each seat they could have held is a net asset to the party. And instead, it was almost a like retreat, like a careful retreat to just make sure they didn't lose Kamloops and Kelowna.
Yeah, and they
giving up the North Shore and, you know, Fraser Valley.
I have to go back and check, but Jazz Joe Hall lost by a very narrow margin, if I recall. Like, there are certainly Metro Vancouver seats that with a little more of a push they could have held on to. And, well, frankly, it was more likely they... And frankly, Kamloops was always going to be safer territory for them than Metro Vancouver, so they screwed up by trying to do a save the furniture thing, but focused on the wrong furniture.
There was lots of criticism to go around in the report as well. There was criticism for Andrew Wilkinson. People, I think, gave him a 4 out of 10 in terms of performance. No one was particularly pleased with how he was on camera. There was some positive that if you met him in person, he had some empathy, but beyond that, like, he couldn't inspire British Columbians. He had incredible difficulty managing the major issues, especially within his own caucus that came up. Jane Thronthwaite and Laurie Thronis were flagged as the particular failures in terms of how he handled those scandals, and we've litigated those to death here.
Yeah, and yeah, it was always going to be a tough election, but it was one that never, or that just did not align with Wilkinson's strengths, such as they are, which, considering his background, is should have probably been an easier sell in a pandemic election, just because he does have that medical background. But that was that, like, one thing that could have helped nudge him in that direction of being more relatable, or at least more on point, just never came through at all. And instead, all the aloofness, coldness, mediated by a medium that just tends to increase it online, just did not help him at all.
And then you connect that with the other big criticism, which was a platform that could just not connect with British Columbians. Issues like the PST cut that had no resonance. And in the middle of a pandemic, there were things that they could have brought forward, things that would have still distinguished themselves from the New Democrats. And instead, it was a hodgepodge that didn't... I can barely remember what they ran on besides the PST cut.
Child care that was like 85% similar to the NDP, but that last 15% was the big difference. A couple other things. There was no real sense from the Liberals of what they wanted to do differently, other than just being the NDP, but going a little slower on some stuff and a little less taxes.
So, on diagnosing the problem, I think you hit the nail on the head at the start, is, and they just still need to figure out what that purpose of the party is. There's a series of lessons learned that we can dig into in a second, but they're all still a bit, some of them are the important stuff, basics of running a political party, but really figuring out the what is the point of view question, I don't think has been addressed in here.
No, it hasn't. And that's a broader question to be asked that will hopefully be answered in the leadership race that's ongoing. But just watching the Liberals in the campaign, and now the only thing I can really pull away from them is that they aren't the NDP, but exactly how they aren't and what they want to do to differentiate themselves is very undefined.
Let's dig into some of the lessons they should be learning according to this report. They were presented in no particular order, and so we'll just burn through and we can stop on some that are a bit more interesting. First up, in no particular order, is invest substantial time and money into recruiting young people and revitalizing campus clubs. This goes with kind of a couple others that tie into the idea of needing to get new energy into the party.
Yeah, no, this is definitely a really good suggestion on their part in terms of trying to build up just the institutions and organizations that exist to help train up young people and provide some structure that is independent of just the we want to get people elected, you know, in the next election and then do the politicking in Victoria stuff. So not the sort of thing that's going to maybe be a one-cycle winner, but definitely work that needs to be done, and that's just something that doesn't really exist right now.
There's a knock-on effect of having those like campus clubs and those younger, energetic wings of the party. Is they're great idea generating areas. Now, they also generate a lot of bad ideas, but there's just a lot of energy and optimism about what your political movement can do at that level, and that's something the party can harness productively to both develop the ideas and the vision that they need, but they can also tap right into what a different demographic wants. Like the BC Liberal Party has for a number of years been, I think, like many conservative parties, getting older. And luckily, older people tend to vote more, but eventually they're not around to keep voting for your party. So you do need to refresh. And that ties into a couple of the other targets, investing time in the digital influencer program and redoubling effort to recruit and foster talent from diverse backgrounds. Like just really expanding the pool of who is BC Liberals. This also even talks about fostering talented elected officials serving at the local level of government who could be like the grassroots team.
Yeah, there's a lot of that can be done, and you would expect that all else being equal, the BC Liberals should be able to represent about half of the province. And no matter how you slice it, that you should generally get roughly half of any group if you can try and work it properly, because generally speaking, the kind of fundamental character traits or the underlying psychology that kind of pushes people in one direction or the other politically, that's going to be more or less evenly distributed across the population. So there shouldn't be a huge reason why you need to be losing young voters by a large margin. And there's always some effects that tend to push younger people a little more to the left. It's easy when you're, you know, 20 and just think of everything and full of going out to change the world energy. That is a certain phase of life that I think leads itself to a more sympathetic view towards a lot of kind of more left-wing ideas. But that's only a small part of it, and that doesn't last forever. And even among that group, there's still going to be quite a few people who have less left tendencies that are definitely winnable if you actually do the work and reach out to them.
Some of the other work that's projected for the party is basic things like set clear and forced targets for incumbents when it comes to fundraising, volunteer recruitment, and voter identification. And this one's a good, simple suggestion, but it's incredible that it needs to be made. Like, when you go through, and we've seen some of the analysis done where you go through the sitting MLAs and look at what their political donations are to their own party, and there are BC Liberals who have not given to the BC Liberal Party in several years, or at least not enough that their name shows up on the database.
Which is what, like $200 or something?
I think it's $250.
Okay.
But the idea is these people are making near six figures, many of them. They're not poor. They can tip a bit back to the party and find other people to engage. And when you have MLAs unable to pay back into your own party, it looks like they're not committed to the team. And we've talked about this before. I think one of the Greens, Adam Olson, has had excuses for why he doesn't donate to his party, but he does do fundraising. And you can work around that. But you gotta try to really push. Because if you can't convince your MLAs to donate to you, how are you going to convince British Columbians to?
Yeah, so the basic compensation of an MLA is $111,024. Hitting the maximum yearly cap is 1% roughly of that. Like, that is not a big outlay for.
And then they get 75% of that back in taxes.
Yes.
Or it doesn't work quite that well.
Not quite.
A large donation, 40? But you get a good amount back.
Yeah.
So they could be doing a lot better on those fronts. Yeah, it's just basic building the team stuff that's not happening, which is like unsurprising, but also incredible. some of the other points involve consider communicating marquee platform ideas ahead of the campaign. We're seeing this federally. Some of the political parties release planks of potential platforms ahead of time. The NDP's talk at the federal level has talked about some of the student loan stuff they do, and sometimes it works really well and other times it's a miss. It doesn't really hurt to do, just the way elections have shifted to much longer periods and the way you don't need to get all of your news hits during the 4-week election campaign. Keeping yourself in the news at different points and having those things to draw upon and get people thinking about can be a very valuable strategy. We've seen it work quite well. I think Trudeau did it fantastically pre-2015. Yeah, tell us what you're going to do next, Liberal leader.
Yeah, it's always a challenge for the opposition parties to get attention, and having that kind of slow trickle of ideas come out and be reinforced is a pretty important way to actually get that done. And then you can do more organic attempts or even paid social media ads to reinforce that a bit more. But yeah, I think the tendency to try and wait until the second to last week of the writ period is not great. Which was one of the things they identified in the report here, is that not only was the platform uninspiring for the most part, but the parts that were released so late that they didn't really help campaigners all that much.
So, I don't know, was there anything else in this report you think is worth pulling out?
The only other thing I'll mention is there was a bit on kind of the media and social media stuff where they identified a perception that those environments were not friendly to them. And I do think there's something to that, but it was remarkably defeatist in how they approached that, rather than realizing that, okay, if the ground's uneven, you actually have to take proactive steps to ensure that you can compete on that rather than just resigning yourself to it. The NDP always gets in trouble for the perception that they're a bunch of tats and spend people with no sense of fiscal responsibility. You see the successful BC NDP, if anything, overcompensate from what their kind of natural equilibrium would be on that to allay those concerns. And the Liberals need to do something similar here, and not just try and go to where they think would be the fair point, but adjust a little more to balance that out.
Yeah. This idea that the media is significantly hostile to the BC Liberals, I don't fully buy. It's kind of, 2020 was a much different year in many ways because of the pandemic. I think there was a deference to governments and the people in power that there normally wasn't. And the media, I would argue, has generally been fairly hostile to the NDP in the past, but it's also hostile to sitting governments. It's the point of the media to not be friendly to any one idea.
Yeah, so, but like,
there is a lot more that, but yeah, your point
I'll
is right.
Push back
there's
on
a
that.
Lot more there's that the Liberals could have done here.
I'll push back on that a bit, just because looking at Alberta, our neighbor, who, as you've joked many times during the pandemic, basically did what BC did with a week's lag between the two. And Kenny got raked over the coals for a lot of the things that the BC government did. And that when there wasn't a huge amount of daylight between the two, the NDP definitely got the kid gloves treatment, particularly with respect to the pandemic. Now, other areas, I think there's a little more debatableness around it, but there was it may not be that the media was necessarily biased against the Liberals, but they weren't exactly holding the government's feet to the fire during a lot of, particularly the past year, but even longer than that.
So the Liberals are left with some lessons to be learned. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. And just throwing off another example that we'll touch on, that's going to tie into the net story a bit. But we had, years of look how unaffordable BC is. Aren't the Liberals terrible for letting the housing crisis get this bad? And the NDP has taken some steps on it, including the report we're going to commission in the report we're going to talk about shortly. But fundamentally, housing is no more affordable than it was 4 years ago. But you generally don't see the same environment in terms of the what gets discussed around that. So there were a few things that I don't think the Liberals are out of line to point to.
There's lots of Liberals can learn from this report. There's lots that I hope they, if they want to be effective and useful political force in the province, get outside their bubble and talk to non-Liberals about, because their bubble has been shrinking for many years. And if you don't talk to people who aren't like you, you probably won't know why they don't like you. So this is probably a reasonable start for the party, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And I guess we'll keep our eye on the leadership race to see what lessons they do learn.
Well, moving on to our next segment. As we teased in the previous one, there's a big new report that came out just this afternoon from the expert panel on housing supply and affordability. This was a jointly commissioned panel between the BC government and the federal government that examined housing affordability and supply issues in BC.
88 pages of wonky housing policy. It sounds delicious. Let's dig in. I found actually one of the appendixes is where I want to start. Appendix 3, which tries to define the problem. And it says there's two affordability problems in BC. First, you have the low-income houses, the many low-income houses who can not afford any market-rate housing, even if the market was significantly lower. And then you have supply shortages in some regions that push up prices beyond what moderate and middle-income houses can afford. That's the, you and I have been largely pushed out of the market in Metro Vancouver, unless you happen to have a family, frankly, to get you in. These two issues require different solutions. Low-income households are actually pretty easy to solve that situation. You just need to provide more subsidized housing or income support, like just either give people houses or the money to rent houses. Pretty easy, just costs a lot. The other issue, how do we make Vancouver affordable for all the millennials? Supply, build is what they come down to.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out that the two aren't necessarily strictly separated, and the more unaffordable the market rate housing is, the greater the demand ends up being placed on the non-market portion, which ultimately just makes it harder to address that for the people who really need the support there too. But yeah, when they looked at it, the big takeaway from this is that there's a whole lot of policy changes that are needed to get the needed housing actually built and people living in it.
They identify 23 recommendations under 5 broad calls to action. Number 1, create a planning framework that proactively encourages housing. Number 2, reforming fees on property development. Number 3, expanding the supply of community and affordable housing. Number 4, improving coordination among and within all orders of government. And finally, number 5, ensuring more equitable treatment of renters and homeowners. Some of these sections are much more interesting than others. The coordinate all levels of government is actually pretty vague, and is just, wouldn't it be great if BC Housing and CMHC talked more often and we brought Indigenous housing groups in there as well?
That one was more interesting for the problems it identified than the solutions it proposed. Most notably on the problem side was that just there's a bunch of different levels of government, each with their own affordable housing programs that aren't structured to align with each other. And it can be a real challenge if, say, you need to go through the City of Vancouver's process that almost always requires a discretionary rezoning to get any affordable housing built, but the CMHC process will only fund projects where the zoning is already in place. So just things like that where the two work at cross purposes, and it's not intentional, but just nobody's really done the work to make sure they get aligned. Or you have cases where deadlines for one funder conflict with another, and you can't actually get all your funding in or aligned up to actually proceed with things. There's a bunch of issues there that just having a more unified approach or common set of standards would greatly help things.
This sounds like all of the issues across the entire nonprofit sector that I hear other executive directors have issues with all of the time. And it's why I rely so heavily on individual donors rather than grants or anything like that, because the paperwork, man.
Yeah. But
and this is particularly bad paperwork that doesn't work.
Yeah, but those challenges also, I think, go to show why it's the just throw non-market housing at the problem doesn't necessarily work that in practice, because there's just a lot of things that interfere with that running smoothly and more importantly, scalable to the size that's needed. One of the things they identify here in the report is that Canada actually has the lowest rate of home building in the G7, and we would need to add 1.8 million units just to bring ourselves up to the average.
So how do we get there? Let's come back to the first call to action, the planning framework that proactively encourages housing. This is talking about speeding up or streamlining processes such as rezoning and development applications to enable a more responsive housing supply. The cities are in the way, Scott.
Yeah, this is it's a perennial complaint of mine in this stuff. So they propose a bunch of changes that will effectively remove barriers or make it easier to proceed. They want to have the BC government follow Alberta and Ontario's example and legislate time limits for the various processes so that it doesn't get to be the case where someone has to go through the city bureaucracy for 3 years before they can get a permit out of it. They want to update the housing needs methodology, which every municipality has to do, to also account for the fact that they've undersupplied for a while and they need to have in an affordability adjustment in there. And they highlight that you can't just look at past housing growth to predict future housing demand, because you can only grow as much as there are houses available for people to move into. And if that is constrained, well, then your growth rates are not reflective of actual demand. So they want to factor in the housing affordability portion of that, which is great. And then they also identify the fact that local governments don't actually take the steps to implement their official development plans and often hold back on making the actual zoning bylaw changes to really implement them. This is something you really see in Vancouver, but yeah, there's also a case elsewhere in the province where if the city decides to do a plan for something, they won't actually change the zoning. They'll write a policy that allows people to come to them and apply for a rezone. And that ties into the next section on fees, because it allows them to charge more fees to it. But they want to put in place requirements that when cities make a plan, they actually have to implement it immediately.
Otherwise, what is the point of the plan? Like they talk about in here, we also recommend reduced reliance on site-by-site public hearings and council approvals that delay home building and amplify the voices of groups opposing new housing at the expense of citywide objectives and affordability, which is exactly what you're just talking about. When the city says, here's our official community plan, we're saying that there should be apartments in this section, row houses and townhomes in the next section, and then we'll leave the single-family homes over there, but we'll put in some, you know, mixed use over here, blah, blah, blah. That's all great, and it'll look like a great change in the city. But like where I was in Burnaby, there were OCPs and neighborhood development plans that were decades old, or decade or two old, that looked like not the community that it had become. Like it's the community that it could become in 50 years at the rate they're going. And it's like, what's the point of your plan if it's one day maybe we'll get to something like this?
Yeah.
Simplify the process, cut out all of the nonsense and the hearings, like have the hearings over the plan, and then just go ahead with it.
Yeah, they mentioned one of the points is better integrate transportation infrastructure spending with the planning. And a perfect example of that is the Canby Corridor, which they actually have a whole block out about there. But Oak Ridge, one of the main stops on the Canby Corridor, it's the designated town center, I think they call it. Anyway, it's this part where they're putting the most density outside of downtown along the corridor. Everybody knows there's going to be, I want to say 18-story buildings allowed right at the intersection there. But they're not actually changing the zoning to allow an 18-story building. The plan basically says, hey, landowner there, you can come to us and apply for a rezoning to get it. And 2 years later, in a contentious public hearing, after a bunch of politicians weigh in on it, then you can maybe do it. And that just makes no sense from a delivery point of view, or even a good governance point of view more broadly.
Yeah, and that's where I think you could view a lens where this report feels very developer friendly in terms of, especially when we get into the next section on fees. But I think the more realistic way is we've put so many nonsensical barriers in the way in this province. Like, I'm not opposed to regulations, but they should have a point. The point shouldn't just be paperwork for its own sake, like forcing projects to go through 4 years of a process just to get rejected. We'll just tell them you can't do it in the first place, and we'll save everyone a lot of frustration.
Yeah, that's, I think, a really important point, is whether whoever this benefits, and let's be very clear, the main beneficiaries of this, if these actions were to be implemented, would be just people trying to find an affordable place to live. But regardless of what you think of who would benefit and who wouldn't, just as a more basic level, there is just a lot of things that don't fit any model of what good governance ought to be in our housing system. And a lot of the points here just can be thought of less as a, this will be good or bad for Group X or business interest why, and more of a, just how should government work, and let's make it better. And the final point here would also be recommending the BC government develop a province-wide digital permitting system that both meets the local government and industry needs, which honestly make a huge amount of sense. I think Gavin Dew talked about it when we had him on the podcast as to something he wanted to see done, and yeah, it makes a huge amount of sense. The city of Vancouver still takes stuff in dead tree format, where you'd have to print it out and walk it down to the city hall, or I guess technically the permitting department across the street, rather than just using a digital system. And I don't work in housing development, but I do work in kind of the broader construction industry. And I honestly can't recall the last time I physically got a set of paper plans delivered to me. Everything is digital these days. There's no reason permitting shouldn't be either. And moving to a province-wide system where the BC government develops one standard, everyone knows what it is and how they need to use it, and it saves all the small little local governments the implementation costs, just make a huge amount of sense.
Yeah, even our legal system relies quite heavily on the fax machine, which is a more modern invention than carrying your plans to the department. But I think our legal system has improved a little bit through the pandemic. You can actually email file some things now, which was amazing when I was in small claims court.
Yeah, I think the goal here is to exceed the peak of 1990s technology and surpass the fax machine.
I will say, having used a few different BC government systems, that maybe we could not have them do it because they suck. And there are other ones. Like, the City of Vancouver's open data portal is actually really good. Why don't we like somehow work that kind of level of technological acumen into this? Anyway, it can be done. Let's talk about fees on development, though, the next section, which I think also has a lot of really interesting ideas. Right now, a lot of the way cities really build up their pool of money, and this was very much the case in Burnaby, Vancouver's doing it as well, is they charge different kinds of fees, whether it's community amenity contributions or development cost levies. These when you're building up a larger, especially some of the high rises or mid-rise buildings, the building developer has to sign a check over to the city to help build all the amenities that the people who will be living there need: parks, fire, expanding the city's services. It makes sense, except as the report says, the well-intentioned, some of these instruments lack transparency and predictability, and in turn discourage home building and increase costs. Like, this is the case hugely in Vancouver, where they're continually a like political wrangling tool, where it's, we'll cut them in this case, but then we're going to raise them in that. And it's just not helping.
Yeah, and they talk about two different types, which I think listeners of the Canby report will maybe be a little more familiar with. But there's both the kind of discretionary CAC, community money contribution, which they really highlight here as just bad governance, like we were talking about earlier. It's one of the, that's a fee that gets negotiated, and which basically means there's uncertainty and it opens up a whole bunch of risks on anything. That gets negotiated for a rezone, which also then incentivizes the government not to do the rezonings when they do their plans, because they want to be able to extract these CACs out of that. So getting rid of them would both change the bad incentives in the system and provide greater certainty.
Now, the problem if you get rid of those is local governments need money, and they're unlikely to raise property taxes enough to cover that difference, because that makes a lot of people really mad.
Do that, because it generally isn't all that equitable to make the newcomers pay for everything.
And oh yeah, I'm not saying they shouldn't do it, but I'm just saying what they do talk about in here is a broader review of how local government is funded. And what's particularly interesting is they highlight land value capture taxes as an opportunity to have a more valuable approach to the city's profiting off development. And do you want to explain what a land value capture tax is, Scott?
Yeah, sure. So right now, when you get your property tax assessment, or if you're like me, your landlord gets it because I rent, but you're actually a homeowner. So you get a property tax assessment from, I think, your city, but the actual assessment's done by BC Assessment. You get it, and it basically tells you how much your property is worth and what you have to pay on taxes for that. And that is assessment is a combination of the value of the land and the value of the thing built on the land. And together, that's your property value, and that's what you get taxed on. What a land value tax does is it basically says whatever you build on there, we don't care about for the purposes of taxation. All that matters is how valuable the land is. And the benefit to that is that it incentivizes better use of land, because if you build if you leave the land empty, or you build a 100-story high rise on it, the taxes are largely going to be the same, but you just get way more societal benefit from the latter. And that also has the additional benefit of when, say, the government spends a couple $1 billion putting a SkyTrain line through an area, that investment raises land values. And by doing a land value capture tax, what you can do is you can actually recoup some of the societally generated benefits from that directly.
Yeah, and this is something that's actually been pretty widely advocated for in Vancouver. And if you go to affordablebc.ca, it's actually a BCGEU campaign to push for land value capture taxes. Like, unions are on board with this just as much as wonky economists and housing economists. So
yeah, or
it's an interesting way to approach it.
Yeah, or George's Twitter, which is its own weird space. Henry George being the original proposer of the land value tax, who hence gives the name to Georgism.
And so the other way they're looking at funding cities is more provincial and federal incentives to encourage building of houses. I didn't dig in enough to get exactly what those would be, but obviously the feds and province have more fiscal capacity than most cities, so getting them involved.
We have programs right now that, for example, help underwrite some of the lending costs that go to market rental developments. I believe CMHC has a program for that. So it would be things like expanding that. Circling back just to the local government thing, I do really like the suggestion of doing a review of local government revenue, because cities are increasingly taking on a wider range of responsibilities, and their revenue raising powers are just extremely limited. And I know the focus here was on the land value capture tax, but I don't know, being able to do what the U.S. cities for the most part, or at least several of them, have the ability to do with, like, put in a local sales tax by themselves might not be a bad idea. Just little things like that, just increasing the number of potential revenue options available to them, because right now it basically amounts to user fees, property taxes, and parking revenue, which I guess actually falls in the first category. So that's just all really limited. And if we're thinking about this also as just a good governance idea, I think expanding those areas of responsibility for local governments would be a big improvement. And hey, if you pair that with, say, maybe slightly less responsibility locally on the land use thing, I think you'd actually probably get a fairly equitable reform in local governance that doesn't necessarily disadvantage either the province or the local governments.
We got two more sections to get through. Number three here is expanding the supply of community and affordable housing. This is the one that's highlighting how far we've fallen in terms of housing construction. And it highlights prior to the mid-90s is where things really started to collapse. This section is really just throw money at it and build more. Like, this is something a lot of people have pointed out, that following Chrétien in the years of austerity in the early 90s, and then when it came to BC with the BC Liberal government, but even the NDP couldn't keep up with the housing need because the province only has so much fiscal capacity. We just fell behind on that bottom level, that affordable, supportive housing.
It's also worth mentioning that the general macroeconomic and government fiscal situation is just so much different than it was in the 90s. Interest rates are way lower. Debt levels, both federally and provincially, are in a really sustainable spot for the most part. And that just means there is just a whole lot more room to invest in long-term assets like housing. That there just is way more space compared to what there was in the 90s. Like, we are not going to have the bond brokers call us up and tell us we're going to have trouble borrowing more money if there was a risk back then. Now that money is so cheap to borrow, it's practically free for governments with good credit ratings and get good rates. So it just makes way more sense to spend now. Oh, and I guess more specifically, the downsides of going big on spending are just way less than they were a couple decades ago.
And you said it right in the middle there, that housing is a long-term asset. It's not like throwing several billion more, tens or hundreds of billions more at housing is just like putting money in a pit and burning it. It's just translating your asset from cash or a loan to houses where people live, which helps your society in many ways. But you can also, if you're the government running them, you can extract rents from those people. I don't generally like that idea in the way Adam Smith doesn't like that idea. If the government's extracting rents from people, it goes back into general revenues and can pay for the expansion and the maintenance of those houses. And
it also makes a lot of sense just, yeah, to help make them self-sustaining over the long term. And what you can do when you're actually willing to extract some rents on there is to make MITS income projects where you can get within the same building some cross subsidies going in addition to the initial subsidies that the government chips in. And that just helps keep it going longer. and also prevents a situation where you have concentrated poverty because you're mixing the income ratios in the projects or single buildings.
Yeah, and so BC has been on this track to build more housing, and we can argue and debate, and it's tough to even figure, like we were talking about with childcare a week or two ago, the numbers in terms of how far the government is getting towards their goal. But this government has at least talked the game about building out more housing and building, starting with temporary modular housing, so there's stuff right away, but then really getting those affordable housing projects and those middle housing projects going. And there's announcement after announcement of breaking ground, at least. So I think there is a commitment and willingness at the provincial level to do this. The federal government has started talking about a national housing strategy. That's all good. It just needs the ongoing sustained commitment to do, and a level of ambition probably above what we're at right now.
Yeah, and also better cooperation from local governments as well. Couple weeks back, and I think you talked about this on the Canby Reporter, was a big story from Francis Buell at the Globe going through the fact that just a lot of the announced projects were tied up in permitting at City Hall here. And that kind of goes into the intergovernmental policies that we were talking about earlier and make up the final segment of the report.
Oh, the final segment, which maybe we can get into now, is the ensuring more equitable treatment of renters and homeowners, because this is the one that has already in part been killed by Selena Robinson as not going to happen.
We're not getting rid of the homeowners grant, you're telling me?
That's what the province has said, and that's what the opposition is screaming about. So basically, this section of the report looks at how we've weirdly incentivized and supported the wealthy class, the homeowning class, me, while punishing those who have to rent, you. We extend tax advantages to homeowners, but not to renters. And so this looks at how we can bring equity back to that situation, or to that situation in the first, for the first time ever. It suggests phasing out certain subsidies currently offered to homeowners, notably the homeowner grant. This, for me, for example, because I'm just an average British Columbian, I get $570 off my property taxes. If I was a old fart, I would get $845 off my taxes, because my house isn't too expensive, thankfully.
Yeah, it's under, where's the last amount the
NDP raised? It's like 1.6 million.
Yeah, the NDP raised it to, I think, 1.65 million.
They raised it with inflation, but yeah, they shouldn't have.
Yeah, real party of the dispossessed and working classes there. But yeah, they've been raising it when they shouldn't. More generally, I don't have a huge problem with a general, you know, feeling that home ownership is good and people should partake in it when they can. But the more general problem is that in pursuit of that fairly worthwhile goal, everything has just become completely unbalanced there. And as a result, it's had some disproportionate effects and ultimately made housing less available and hurt the very goal of expanding home ownership. So a rebalance would be good. The thing that actually caught my eye more than the homeowners grant, which there was no way that was ever going to fly, although, like we were saying, the NDP had any balls, they would just stop raising it every year and let inflation eat away into it. But alas, they aren't. Instead, they're looking at changing some of the taxation provisions that favor homeowners, instead proposing to, if they can't do that, just introduce some benefits to renters, whether it's a tax deduction or tax credit for rents, or even more interestingly, a renter's tax-free savings account contribution.
Yeah, I didn't fully understand this. I guess it would be like your TFSA limit would increase if you're a renter versus if you are a homeowner.
It wasn't
as a way to put your income into somewhere that you could, since you don't gain equity, you could at least gain wealth in a different way.
Yeah, and it wasn't entirely clear if it was going to amount to basically a government chips in contribution equal to what a homeowner would get into that, which as far as a wealth building mechanism, having the government chip in a little bit to renters, offset the lack of wealth building through real estate, isn't the worst idea. Or could have been just a raise the cap for renters, so renters would have one cap and homeowners would have another, which doesn't strike me as ideal because I don't know how many renters actually just have enough disposable income that they're maxing out their TFSA every year.
So that's where the tax deduction or tax credit might be a smoother way in. And we already have a great example for this. And this lets me bring up a bit of work I just did this past week, is we released a report at the BC Human Association on the clergy residence deduction. And this is this weird line on your income taxes that I've always noticed and never really figured out what it does. It lets you deduct the full cost of your housing if you're a member of the clergy on your taxes. Or if you're a homeowner, it would be the market rent for your home.
Huh.
And you get to reduce your net income by that amount for taxation purposes. So this works out to letting you reduce your taxes by about a third in most cases. And because most provinces have a tax collection agreement with the federal government, your provincial taxes are also reduced. It's huge. There is a bit of a cap on it now that's been introduced in the last few decades, but priests get a huge tax deduction just by being priests. And hey, I'm not saying we should afford that to all renters. I was just saying it was a weird one we looked at, and it's quite generous. It costs the federal government $100 million a year.
Huh,
probably
something I did not know we had in the tax.
For 27,000 people, only 27,000 people get this deduction.
Huh.
And it costs $100 million.
Oh, today I learned.
But we could extend it to all renters. Might be a bit too generous at that point, but we could find a middle ground maybe.
But yeah, as home ownership gets harder to access, just generally, and particularly here in BC, it would be good for governments to put some thought into how to incentivize or support alternative wealth building means, and a TFSA contribution or some change in rent tax credits there isn't a bad one. The state of Oregon has a program that is an opt-out savings program that basically automatically sends, I think it's 5% of people's salaries into what's effectively the U.S. version of a TFSA, and that gets automatically invested in a target date index fund. And like, all you need to do if that program doesn't work for you is file a one-page piece of paper that says, nope, don't want to participate. And maybe BC should be looking at something similar, because people are just not great at building their own savings program and doing it automatically. So a little nudge like that wouldn't be a bad idea and could actually help people quite a bit towards doing some wealth building. And I'd be really interested to see either the government or perhaps people looking to make a splash on their BC Liberal leadership campaigns to introduce that as an idea.
Yeah, taking this report in its entirety, it's a really fascinating document, and it's got some great examples and very readable breakout boxes that explain a lot of the deeper issues of housing policy that we probably glossed over or have delved into. There's a whole explainer box on NIMBYism, if that's your thing. You shouldn't be a NIMBY, let me say that at least. I was really impressed by this report. I'm hopeful we'll see at least some of this start to move forward with the government. I'll be interested to watch what they do manage to pick up, if they're at least able to say, obviously, we're not going to cut the homeowners grant, but we will be taking some of the other recommendations into consideration. I'll still consider that a win. There's enough meat in here that I'm hopeful
we can move
forward on.
I am really happy with the content in here. And if you ask me to write down a list of housing policy ideas that the government should do, short of taking zoning power out of the hands of cities, this is more or less what I would have liked to have seen done. And altogether just a really good report that, if implemented, would make significant strides towards addressing a lot of the housing challenges here in the province, and I'm hopeful the government takes it up and that the vast majority of people who are interested in having better housing affordability, either for themselves or if they're a long-time homeowner, for their family and people they know, start pushing the government to actually follow through on this.
Well, moving on to quick takes, let's circle back to the Green Party of Canada for our only quick take. This is going to be an extended one, but let's treat it as a few different stories. I thought this could almost be our main segment, but then I saw this housing report and I'm like, we'll talk about that. That'll be more fun than whatever the shit show is that is this last week. Like, I thought it was bad last week, and then it just went worse.
Well, it's fun in the way, like, watching a horror movie can be fun, and, like, the sheer awe of just how big a disaster it is.
Also, having so low stakes, yes. Right? If it was, like, watching the Trump presidency was terrifying, but if he was, like, a student council president, it would just be funny, because it wouldn't matter, and that's where this is. Like, no offense to our Green listeners, but when your party has three and then two seats, there are lower stakes involved, so we can breathe a little bit more and just enjoy the political wildness. So let's start on Monday with Jenica Atwin, who released a follow-up statement now that she's a Liberal.
Yeah, the supposed reason, or one of the ideas that was out there, can't recall if Atwin had actually said it herself, but that was definitely the thing that was read into her floor crossing, was the eruption over differing views within the Green Party on the conflicts in the Middle East. And outspoken member of the Green Party, she very much aligned herself with the Palestinian cause. And on Monday, she put out a letter that, well, took a very different tact, basically coming down on the both sides have a point. Anti-Semitism's wrong, Islamophobia's wrong, let's listen and work together. The most middle of middle ground positions on this, which granted is in line with her newfound party, but boy was that a bit of whiplash on that.
Yeah, on first reading there was nothing like objectionable about it. It's very, yeah, that's all very reasonable stuff.
Yeah, but if anything, I find myself more agreeing with kind of the general thrust of this than some of her earlier statements, but it also, I said, what's that saying that gets, you know, the Liberal Party has principles, and if you don't like it, we're free to change them. It really felt like a case of, well, new party, new principles, which just made the whole thing just feel very hollow.
And after that news broke, which was barely news, the Liberals the Greens continued to have problems, particularly at the leadership level. I don't remember if it was at the end of last week or in this past week, but there was a statement from Elizabeth May and Paul Manley really just begging Atwin to come back and also saying they wouldn't leave. I think that came out last week, but May was really like, there was some simmering discontent you could tell between the MPs and the leader. And this all kind of culminated in an emergency meeting of the Green Party National Council 2 days ago, I believe on Tuesday, or maybe it was on Wednesday. It's all blending together, where they essentially were going to say, should we kick Annamie Paul out of her seat as leader tonight, or should we give her a month to make things up? And they opted for the latter.
Yeah, first off, on the statement by May and company on that, there is zero chance Atwin is going to reverse course and come back to the Greens, no matter how nice Annamie Paul or her potential soon-to-be successor is.
You mean Elizabeth May?
Yes, the return of Elizabeth May. There is no way someone politically survives crossing the floor twice in a week's time. that is a complete non-starter, and to even suggest it portrays a shocking level of naivete for someone who's been in Parliament for over a decade now.
And we'll get into the naivete of the current leader of the Greens in a minute, but let's talk about what the Green executive did decide to do earlier this week. They passed a motion ultimately asking Annamie Paul to publicly repudiate her, it's called, they say former senior advisor, but I'm not actually sure what Noah Zatzman's role is in the party right now. I don't believe he's involved in the party, but he may or may not still be an advisor to Annamie Paul herself. This is the guy who publicly said he would campaign against the sitting MPs because he thought they were raging anti-Semites. Jenica, he didn't name them, but pretty much everyone assumed it would be Jenica Atwin and Paul Manley.
Yeah.
And she has not done that. She was also supposed to give her explicit support for the caucus.
Yeah. Any chief of staff would be fired if they did that. If Jeff Mage went on Twitter and started posting about how he was going to campaign against one of the BC Liberal MLAs, I don't know, David Eby or whoever it is, you can bet your ass that he will be packing his office up and be unceremoniously thrown out of the legislature building after that. It is just not something staff do, to publicly threaten an elected member with of their own party campaigning against them. And the fact that Paul didn't immediately and very publicly fire him is not a positive reflection on just the basic competency as a political leader.
Yeah, on Wednesday, she held a press conference to, I don't know, respond to this. And instead of repudiating Zatzman, said the efforts to eject her are led by, quote, a small group of party members who are, quote, on their way out. And then she threw around allegations of racism, sexism, and that much of this was being pushed without consultation with other party members. And I touched on this last week, and I take seriously the allegations of sexism and racism within the Green Party just as much as I would take them seriously within any political party in this country. There are serious systemic barriers to women, people of color in political office. I don't doubt that for a second. But the immediate lash out at that and the refusal to recognize the issues with Zatzman and how he has undoubtedly created a toxic environment for other caucus members, it speaks to that naivete and that, and a weird like attachment to the party she is going to make it versus what it needs to be a successful party.
Yeah, they attempt to do that, and some of her later comments around JoJo just, yeah, feel a little like not taking responsibility and deciding to instead make the, you know, fairly serious allegations on that front rather than accepting that even if those were factors, there's definitely a level of personal responsibility to address one's own failings in this that she's just not showing at all.
Yeah, and you mentioned the attack on Trudeau, and she, in that first press conference and in a later interview, lashed out at Trudeau for trying to undermine her leadership. She said he was trying to undermine strong women, capable women at the height of their careers, and is pushing strong, competent, capable women out of politics. Like, I'm believing, like, she might be indirectly referencing like Jody Wilson-Raybould, Jane Philpott, Cesar Chavanez. I think I screwed that up. I apologize. That series of women we had just before the 2019 election. At the same time, parties are going to want people to cross the floor to them, unless they're the NDP, where they're opposed to floor crossing and think you should run in a by-election. But most parties are going to want, like the Green Party has taken MPs as floor crossers when Elizabeth it suits them.
May, as the leader of the Green Party, actively courted the floor crossing of
Pierre Nantel.
Yeah, that, and I was going to say, definitely talked up or publicly mused about Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott coming over to the Greens. Like, this is hardly something the Greens have clean hands on. And more to the point, like, this is something any politician would do, and any politician should expect to have done to them. It's just part of politics, and no matter the race, gender of whoever was as leader of that case, there will be an attempt to undermine opposition parties and support one's own party, because that is what parties do in a competitive political environment. And ultimately, throwing around accusations of racism and sexism on that just, if anything, weakens the power that those fairly serious accusations ought to have when they're so casually thrown about when not necessarily appropriate.
Let's remember, Justin Trudeau has done blackface more times than he can remember and did have these serious run-ins with fairly prominent women within his own caucus. And the comments from Cesar Chavanas were pretty serious coming out. That said, it's very easily explained that he doesn't want the leader of another party to succeed because they're the leader of another party.
Yeah. Period. Let's pretend that the 2020 Green leadership race had gone. So 2020? No, it's this year, wasn't it?
The Green leadership race was last October.
What is that? Yeah. So let's say that Dimitri Lascaris, is that it? Yeah. Had won and had to deal with a caucus revolt and a floor crosser. Does anybody think that Trudeau would not have tried to seize on that opportunity and would have done anything differently in that case? Obviously not. Like, it's entirely expected here. So,
the last bit I'm going to go into is Paul, in an interview on 640 Toronto on Thursday morning today, said, I'm going to also say shame on Chrystia Freeland for her complicity in this, for being his female shield against all of that. She has a role to play. She was in these conversations with Jenica Awin. Like, Paul is almost flailing madly or
not only this.
And Chrystia Freeland came out and said, I'm not a token. I'm not a shield. I stand, and I would never, ever accuse another woman of being that.
Yeah, it's hard to play the feminist card when you're basically insinuating that both the woman who left your party and a prominent woman in another party are basically little more than puppets of Justin Trudeau. That is itself a very sexist allegation to make.
So, lots still happening in the Green Party. July 20th will be the deadline for this vote of non-confidence within the party exec. I'm hearing rumblings from lots of different elements. Even if Paul can survive this, I think there's a lot of activists and younger members and just different people in the party who are just not wanting to deal with this. So,
I mean, yeah, it's a mess.
Yeah, it's not a good team.
It's a mess that's going to make it harder to recruit people and whatnot. But also, like, it just raises questions about basic judgment and whether or not Paul is going to be capable of leading the party forward. There were already doubts about it based on the rather bizarre choice to run in the safest Liberal riding in Canada, more or less, trying to get a seat in the next election. And then this is just going to compound it. So, the Green Party is no stranger to political incompetence, malpractice, whatever you want to call it. But, like, they were on a path to professionalization that is just completely disintegrated now. So, yeah.
Let's leave it there.
The dumpster fire keeps on burning.
This time a little more green.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.